Hello and welcome to Sundays with the Modern. I'm Leslie Merle, Assistant Curator of Education, and it's my pleasure to introduce you to our speaker today. Christina Reese graduated from the University of North Texas and then went on to write art criticism for publications like the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Met, the Dallas Observer, and the Village Voice in New York. She went on to become the full-time editor of the Met and then associate editor at D Magazine. She was then director of the Engstrom Gallery in Dallas, and then the owner and director of Road Agent, excuse me, a critically acclaimed contemporary art gallery over in Dallas. In 2009, she was appointed curator of the art galleries at Texas Christian University, and her current show is called Yuri's Office. It's by Eve Sussman and the Rufus Corporation, and it's open until October 31st. Please join me in welcoming Christina Reese.
Testing, can you all hear me? Well, that was working pretty well. I just saw this show for the first time 20 minutes ago, but I'm very familiar with his work, and I love Vernon Fisher, and I went to North Texas, and he was teaching there when I was there, and it was kind of like having a rock star at the school. So seeing this show is almost like walking into... People have heard me say this before, but I really learned to look at artwork through this kind of prism of Vernon Fisher, because when I was in school, even though I wasn't necessarily in art school, I took some art classes, he was such the reigning king of the kids who ended up being these great conceptual artists that were going to school with me, that was kind of the stepping stone for me to a greater art world. And so walking in here is like walking into my own brain's living room or something like that. It's that familiar for me. It's almost as though I was there while he was making a lot of this. And a lot of it I've seen before, and some of it I haven't. There's some new stuff. So there were three things that I really wanted to touch on today. One was the idea of a regional artist versus a provincial artist. Vernon is here. He's lived here quite bravely and stoically for most of his career, if not all of it. I think he went to grad school in Illinois. He's been very recognized internationally and on both coasts. He's had dealers on both coasts. He's been in Whitney Biennials, at least three, et cetera. I think that him having a big show here it's kind of a homecoming in a way. It's very appropriate. It looks fantastic in there. I'm so pleased and excited. I also didn't want to walk through the show and be so familiar with it that I didn't have that kind of feeling of electricity and excitement that happens when you walk into a show for the first time, because I knew I'd probably like it, but I didn't know I was going to like it as much as I do. It's fantastic. The second thing that I wanted to talk about was the sort of central tension in his work and why it works so well and why there's so many different ways to explore that in a way that feels new with every work, but is also familiar to us. It's almost like, I was gonna kind of compare them maybe to like the Rolling Stones, that there's a sound, a quality to that that we recognize even if we haven't heard the song before, but it's a new song. And I think that what he's done is he's created a language that the longer that you spend time with the work, the more you understand his vocabulary and the way it relates to your own ways of projecting your experiences onto it. He's open enough to let you bring to the work what you need to, but you're going to start to see these motifs that are repeated throughout the work, and that's what's familiar, and that's like hearing Keith Richards' guitar intro to a Rolling Stones song. It's like, aha, Vernon Fisher, here we go. So, and then the third thing is about the way that he allows us to project our experience, because when I walk through, I start to have all that. He's got so many sub-references and references. He's so into film. He's so into literature. He's even talked about how he's almost like an abstract artist with the vocabulary of a novelist. Narrative is very important to him. He's not rejected the idea of pure abstraction. He's built upon it, and it kind of goes beyond postmodernism. I think one thing about Vernon that's so beautiful is he's incredibly brave. He's brave enough to be honest. He's brave enough to be funny. He loves the absurdity. He's kind of got this defeatist thing going on throughout his work that's just very true. He's not afraid of nostalgia. He uses it in a very, very intelligent way. He's one of the smartest artists I've ever been able to talk to about his work in person. So I wanted to just, since this one's out here, and I think that sometimes the museum was going to put a piece out here that sort of sums up or epitomizes the show, but the slate, the blackboard thing, what he does is he takes the motif or the kind of the thing in Vernon's work is he superimposes or starts with a system of organization. He finds a thing that is centrally organizing to what would otherwise be chaotic, whether it's the chaos in his head or the chaos out in reality, in nature. So he uses maps, grids, in this case a blackboard. He uses biology, cellular physics, and he starts to... He recognizes that his own work is about trying to organize his thoughts, which he says are all over the place. He considers himself a fairly sort of neurotic, anxious guy. So he puts these parameters into place, these rules that he has to work within, and then he lets the sort of chaos happen within it. Reality is ugly sometimes, and it plays a really hard game with memory and time. So you see that. So we've got this kind of organizing factor of the blackboard itself, which kind of puts in the actual boundaries of the piece. And then he's got the human skeleton. These are all these ways that the humans have tried to organize the cosmos. And then we've got... He also has these little sculptural elements in there, the faucets that turn on and off, which is very funny, and the mix of that. In a blackboard for him, I think what he would say, and I don't, you know, is that it's not about a learning tool so much as it's a place where people brainstorm. It's where ideas are developed, they're erased, they're built upon, and it's almost like the lab, the laboratory of the mind. So. So you're going to start seeing these motifs. You're going to see blackboards. You're going to see different kind of organizational systems. You're going to see what he does this thing right here. He takes an image. Water is really very prominent in his work, and he paints it very kind of photorealistically, but usually in one tone, one color. And that's a kind of this romantic tension that is put into the work instead of it all being sort of analytical or lab-like. You've got this reference to a much more sort of romantic, and it's almost more like memory or sort of a seeking of something a little bit more poetic. So I was just going to use that as a cornerstone for the show. So let's move into here. And I think a lot of the speakers for this show, I think I'm the first speaker for this show, and I'm sure a lot of them are going to start with this wall over here, because I think, and so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but it is great. And I've never actually seen this in person before, but I think that this is I think this is 1979. This is a really good point when Vernon started to figure out what his organizing way of going about making art would be, which is he juxtaposes these very different things and then allows people to draw a narrative between them. So we've got this story right here, which is a rather grim but sort of sad and funny story about a camper who's been in some sort of an accident and has blood splatters on him. We've got Nancy over here with her aunt, and somebody's thrown a bar of soap through the window, and it's splashing into this fudge mix, and that's splattering fudge onto them. And then you've got these birds, and of course people try to kind of systematically organize the birds in the various types. And when you read the story, look at the birds, and look at this, even on an unconscious level, you're going to start drawing this sort of narrative path between them. You're going to read the birds as something that really can't be organized. They're actually, it's very kind of splattered out there. They're red and they're orange, and and you don't want to get too literal, though. I mean, I feel like I'm already getting too literal, but I think that what happens is you look at this in 1979, which is kind of the early mature Vernon Fisher, I think you start to see the way his mind works and the way that he kind of invites you in. And by using things that are familiar, like Nancy, the Bride of Frankenstein, Erector sets, he's giving you something to engage with. It's not going to be so obtuse that you can't get in there and start bringing your own associations with it. I've really liked this. So we've got the Bride of Frankenstein, and we've got these Erector sets over there. And, you know, it's not a huge leap to understand that, you know, she was erected by Dr. Frankenstein, and we've got the Erector sets, but things go wrong. And he's dealing with that kind of melancholy or that kind of disappointment that happens in life. And he's so smart about it that he tends to also be sort of funny. And I think that humor is often overlooked as one of the more intelligent ways of communicating, but I think there should be an Academy Award for funniest movie. But so we'll go over here, and then we'll start to kind of talk about the associations that we bring to things. So we've got the big blackboard again, and then we've got all these sets of molds of people's teeth, their jaws. And as I said, anxiety and tension is very recurrent in his work, and many of the best artists' work anyway. I was thinking, I've never talked to him about the teeth in his work. I think that, my automatic thing is that teeth are the things that kind of, earlier than some other things in our body, start to remind us that we're mortal. They start to... You get cavities, tooth decay, gum disease. We have to go to the dentist. It's an unpleasant experience for a lot of us. I was thinking about Martin Amis, the writer who, in one of his earlier novels, started to really talk about all these nightmares that he has about his teeth crumbling. He had really bad teeth, and when he started to make some money, he went and got his teeth fixed. And my teeth are fine, but I have terrible dreams about my teeth crumbling or losing them or getting knocked out. I think that this is just kind of almost a universal sense of, I have to wonder if it's as common as people dreaming that they go into their junior high school with no clothes on or something like that. But also these sections that come up and meet in a globe and in nature, found in oranges and pumpkins, you'll see some of this stuff, parachutes, the idea that these disparate ideas can come together into a single point that actually makes sense, as long as you give it a chance. He uses battlefields, the heart of darkness. You'll see a lot of Joseph Conrad, the heart of darkness sort of playing out. He uses, I'm not even sure what these, he uses Johnny Weissmuller as Tarzan and the whole idea of... earlier exploitation of Africa. These are politicized, but not explicitly, which is usually not being too explicit is one of the things that I sort of look for in art. I think of him also as being sort of this physiological artist. He's really looking at biology and the way it systemizes things and the way that it goes wrong. I was thinking of Lars von Trier. We can walk over here to this Hindenburg. Lars von Trier just did a movie called Antichrist, and I haven't seen it, and I probably won't, because I know it's meant to be very upsetting. But I do know that one of the sort of startling images is, it's about a family, it's about a couple, and they've lost their child, and in order to go through the grieving process, they go out into the deep woods to find some sort of relaxation and sanity, but it's, you know, the forest sort of treats them like a James Dickey novel. It's almost like a deliverance sort of insanity, and they stumble upon a fox that's been trapped and is dying, and it's this animatronic sort of intentionally ridiculous fox, and he's saying to them, chaos reigns, and then slowly but surely the woman is going mad after losing her child, and some very, very bad things happen after that. So I was thinking of Chaos Reigns when I was looking at some of these images as well. This is the Hindenburg. You can see the beginnings of, or when, you know, the whole idea of organization and grids and numbering here. And this is just a very kind of succinct, I think fairly poetic, Vernon Fisher, basically. I don't know what year this is. This is a good one. 89. 200 numbered rectangles. You also can reference, I mean, you know, one of the great things about all of these contemporary artists who have come up in the world making art at the same time is you see other artists work in their work. They tend to reference it. I see Chris Burden in this, for sure. You see Rauschenberg in his work. You see, oh my gosh, you can almost, the great thing also about him is, as like the Rolling Stones, is you can like name 1,000 references and influences and people playing off of one another. This was in a show that I curated over at Fort Worth Contemporary called Death of a Propane Salesman, Anxiety and the Texas Artist. And when I did a studio visit with him, what we were really talking about was anxiety. And he was saying that that's a real driving force in probably many, if not most, artists' work. And he was also talking about how, more explicitly about how he uses the grid to enforce a kind of organization where there wouldn't normally be. And he said that when he started to do these paintings, this particular set, that he was just going to go ahead and paint whatever he wanted to, whatever came to mind. It's almost like a stream of consciousness that's happening here. And he wanted to see what would happen. And in fact, he says that when he starts out on a painting, he doesn't really know where it's going to go or how it's going to end up. He doesn't have an end result in mind. And he likes to see where it goes. He doesn't like to do commissions because of that, which makes total sense to me. So he was even in this one allowing himself to start drawing narrative out of these different elements. And you see anxiety and humor. And he also has these, I'm not going to talk about his alter egos, but some of the speakers, Matt Sontag is here, and he's going to talk about alter egos at another date. Some of the other speakers will talk about different things. He's got 3 alter egos that he uses, and this is this grid. There's a signature at the bottom. It's one of his alter egos' names. Here's the, again, when you start to see these kind of familiar motifs going through, you see the pith helmets, you see Kong, King Kong, and gorillas and apes. You see all of these allusions to Africa again. Here we've got the parachute, which is the sections that come up into a point with, again, the sort of the monochromatic painting. Instead of collaging it on, he actually goes and does it by hand. That kind of gives it this this element of removal from the source material, which is important for that kind of separation of the more tactile that he's dealing with and the more romantic of what he's dealing with. I wanted to go look at this piece back here with the umbrella. That's Vernon. Vernon writes. He writes his own short stories and the like, and he writes sad, short, to the point, slightly absurd narratives. They are well written. It is a real exercise for him. He works on this, and this is one of the saddest things he's done. This was in his studio when I did the last studio visit with him, and so when he gets very, very text-based, which I really love because I think it works very well. The stories tend to be quite dark and quite sad, and this is his take on the origin of bats. And his undergraduate degree was in literature, and then you've just got, and this is this is not overly heady. It's just, it's his idea on the take-up bats, and then you've got this stretched out sort of membrane of the umbrella over the the frame that's hanging upside down, and all of that's sort of included in the text. You should just take a minute to read it, because it's, I'm easily saddened, though. Plus, I'm worried about the world's bats. And he probably is, too. We have Nauman and the neon. When I'm thinking about kind of regionalism versus provincialism, we'll not walk by the Oldenburg. Let's go back in here. I think that, the fact that information is so easy to come by and that we can access almost anything we want to learn about immediately through the internet is an interesting thing. I also think that New York, as it becomes increasingly the land for the wealthy, has been more and more hostile to artists trying to live and work there. It feels to me like New York, and I did live there. I lived in New York for a bit after 2001, and it feels like New York has become really the market for art, but less of a viable place to live and make art because it's so expensive to live there and it's so hard to live there. And Roberta Smith recently, she's maybe a little bit late on the uptake, but she was talking about what is viable about artists staying in their hometowns or their home states and making their work there. And she actually said something about David Bates, which was interesting, but she made some sort of probably passive-aggressive comment about, against my better judgment, I seem to like David Bates' work or something like that. But I think there's something very brave and interesting about artists that have chosen to stay where they're from. And when you think about some of the artists who are from here, who've really made a name for themselves outside of North Texas or Texas, and you think about Vernon Fisher is one, Eric Swenson is a young one who's going to be talking next week about this show, Trent Doyle Hancock. The imagery that they use, the sort of language and the motifs, or the ideas that they use are not provincial, but they're not denying their geography or where they're from either. And I think that if you look at David Bates versus Vernon Fisher, you see sort of the difference between the idea of something sort of provincial, where you could say, well, I think that this person lives not in the big city and is not dealing with big city ideas or the kind of urbanity of that. And then you look at Vernon Fisher, and you couldn't necessarily tell where he's from, but even the name of the show is Kmart Conceptualism. He's not rejecting he's not even recognizing what's low in culture in a place like the Bible Belt or Texas. It's just part of his DNA. And the way he'll put, I guess as a kind of an analogy, the way he'll put flies on an abstract painting, and there aren't very many fly paintings in this show. In fact, I only see one on the back wall over there. It's kind of this idea, it's not dirty and low that a fly has landed on a painting. It's just reality. That's just how it is. And although I do have a funny story, one of the first Vernon Fishers I saw in a collector's house, it was Sonny and Bob in Dallas, and they said that they had, and it was one that had a lot of flies on it, and they had a house cleaner who sprayed the whole thing, a whole can of Raid on the painting. Which Vernon knows about and thinks is funny, because he's good like that. It ruined the painting. Oh, I wanted to look at the pumpkins over here. And this kind of ties into my thing about regionalism versus provincialism. I don't feel like I'm necessarily articulating this as well as some people could, but I think this is a good kind of booster for this idea, which is he's got this pumpkin patch, which is, again, the kind of segments coming up into the point. And it's this great color. And these are, you know, and then he's painted this really wonderful kind of, weirdly, it feels like nostalgia to me, you know? It's, it feels like memory being superimposed on another memory. And some things are clearer than others. This is all sort of weirdly crystal clear. But sometimes it's just moments that are extremely clear rather than entire scenarios. And it's almost like in a dream or in the retelling of a story that something comes back to you with such incredible clarity. You don't have to apologize for that either. I get very frustrated with critics or historians who are derogatory toward a certain kind of emotion in artwork. They think it's syrupy, or they think that it's... He's not syrupy anyway, but I don't have a problem with nostalgia, and I think that that's part of what makes us who we are, and I think it's always changing. Obviously, time and memory, as we know, really alters reality as we know it, and although these are locked in... the pumpkins are locked in a sort of ripeness, they're not going to... These aren't going to rot. He's controlled that by casting them. And then we're going to go back to, and we're kind of wrapping up, but I wanted to say that, you know, a good artist, like a good filmmaker or rock band or whatever, is also bringing something new to the table that's still recognizable. And this is something that he's done for this show. I was very surprised to see it, but really pleased. I wish I had been here while he was doing it or while he was overseeing it happening, but gorillas, monkeys, primates, King Kong, again, Africa, Heart of Darkness, all these kinds of strange things from his childhood, watching lots and lots of Tarzan movies. He brings in, he's also, one of the things that makes this automatically Vernon Fisher is he's put this little boat down here, which is this kind of crazy battlefield with its very recognizable piece of language. I was thinking also about a book like A Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess. When you start to read it, it's written in such heavy slang, and this precedes the film that Kubrick did. It's written in this such heavy slang that's very based on Russian, and it's in English, that it takes about 80 pages before you start to be able to understand everything that you're reading, but you can. If you stick with it, it all starts. It's like learning a new dialect within your own language, and I think that the more time you spend with the show, that's what starts to happen. It all starts to come together and make more sense, and so I think that the ship is one of these ways that it's like we're back at kind of Vernon Fisher True North, and but it's very playful, and it's very strange, and it's very aggressive, and I love the ambition of it, and I think that's one of the things that marks some of these great artists, is just the pure ambition. I mean, there can be really big paintings that are terrible, but when you've got really big pieces that are great, you've made this sort of incredible statement, and then you have a show in the Fort Worth Modern. That's great. And then... I guess I was going to probably wrap it up with this, although there is a fly painting on the other side of this. It's a small one with just a few flies, and you might want to take a look at that before I leave you. But this piece right here, you know, bringing these different... So he's got this organizational thing. Actually, is this the one that you were talking about, Matthew? This one right here? Yeah, it's interesting. I had not seen this one before. So he's got this organizational kind of frame that he's got... I'm not used to seeing these casts of hands. This, you know, we're looking at references to Jasper Johns here and Rauschenberg. and others. And then we've got, but what I wanted to call your attention to is this text here in the middle. He's got this these three different things that are happening in the universe at the same time, which is kind of this idea of synchronicity, this Jungian concept of synchronicity. Of course, I couldn't help but think of the Police song. Many miles away, a shadow on the surface of a dark Scottish loch. You know, this. But these three very different things, and he's trying to, in his mind, allow these things to come together as and find the meaning in these three very, very different things. They may or may not be connected, but he's going to let them be connected in this piece right here. And again, I just have to say, the more time you spend with his work, the more you understand his semiotics, his language, the thing that he's created that helps him make sense of his own very, very complex and smart mind. And he's one of those artists who, the more you talk to him, the more you, the more wowed you are by what he's able to, he's incredibly articulate and very self-knowing. And it just makes it that much more impressive. So I think he's going to talk about this work. Do you know what the date is for that? It's October 24th. October 24th, Vernon will be here talking about this work, and I would very much encourage you to see that, because that'll blow the top off of it. So anyway, enjoy the show. I'm going to look at it some more. Thank you for listening to my ramblings, and yeah. Thanks. Oh, good.